the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Can you imagine a situation where a man murders his wife and is convicted in the courts of doing that and goes to serve a life imprisonment, and yet he still has the legal rights over the three young children who were left behind after the murder and left behind in circumstances we'll detail in a moment. David French is with us because he has written the story of his sister's death at the hands of her husband and its devastating aftermath. It's called For Valerie. David French, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you just remind us, please, of what happened to Valerie, just for those people who are not familiar with the case?
So, yeah, my sister, Valerie French, was murdered by her husband in June 2019 at the family home outside Castlebar. The three young children were in the house. Valerie's body was left there. He escaped. Gardaí apprehended him the next day. And, yeah, he's been in prison ever since. That's about the size of it.
That's the sort of the short version of it.
Exactly, exactly. I think it's important to put the short version in because, you know, so much stuff gets put out when there's a court trial, you know, defense, prosecution, supporters of his might put out stories. And it's good to kind of put the story straight. Like, these are the facts of what happened and they're not contested by him.
I suppose, though, it did take a long time to reach that. That's one of the things, you know, justice delayed. Not justice denied because you finally got it. Mm. But my God, you had to wait a long time, didn't you, before he was finally convicted?
Yes, there were two collapsed trials. It just collapsed for various reasons around witnesses and stuff like that. But yeah,
that must have been very difficult, though, to be present for that and then discover, OK, this isn't going to be finished. We have to go and do it all again.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, we had well over half a dozen trial dates. You know, trial dates were set, then they move, then they delay. You know, you've maybe 1 week of notice and you find out, oh, the trial's not happening. You know, you've booked up. It sounds trivial, but like you've booked all this, you've made arrangements.
Yeah.
You're going to be out for a month, maybe. And then it gets thrown back and you're like, oh, right.
Tell us about Valerie, please, just before we get into the dreadful circumstances of her death.
Yeah, Valerie was amazing. Very creative, very, very positive. That came out everywhere in her personal life and her professional life. And I think it's really important to stress, you know, she was out there kind of doing an important job. She wasn't some shy wallflower or anything like that. She was great socially, you know, fitted in with any group of people and very empathetic. Fantastic mother and still massive joy for life. You know, she was 41 when she was murdered, but if you kind of looked at her behaviours, it was more like a teenager in a lot of ways. She was really a lot of fun.
What age were the boys when she was killed?
I'd rather not go into specific detail, but they were, how do I say it? The three of them were under 10. Yep. That's okay. Probably the clearest thing.
And tell us a little bit about her husband, James Kilroy, because he comes across as a bit of a waster, maybe. He was leaving her literally carry the burden of bringing up the family.
Yeah, I mean, she'd basically been operating like a single parent family. The words somewhat of a waster were used by prosecution in the trial, so I'm not adding anything to that. James Kilroy worked as a basic ranger in the NPWS in Ballycroy National Park, and he'd been there for a while. It came out, you know, Valerie was earning a lot more than he was, and still he was spending money on drugs and toys for himself. So he wasn't a support for the family.
Yeah, video game addict to an extent, was he?
Video games, buying his camper van that wasn't useful for the family. It couldn't carry the five of them. Went off and bought a motorcycle, you know, had the latest gear when it came to GoPro cameras or, you know, having a couple of guns. He seemed to be spending money on himself in a way that didn't match their circumstances. They're a young family with mortgage kids.
And did you feel at that stage, you know, as his brother and other people in the family, that he wasn't any good for her? Or were you aware of any of this really at the time?
We weren't aware of the full situation, obviously. A lot came out afterwards. We were careful not to kind of be openly critical of him in front of Valerie because she was a very loyal person. And that's you know, you look back and go, like, could we have done something? Could I have known something?
And then the murder was vicious. We won't go into what he did because it is absolutely dreadful in its violence. I understand, though, you had to go and identify her, did you?
Yes, I felt that was something I could do for Valerie. And it needed to be done at the time. And it just kind of wrapped up the loose end, as it were. You know, the body is evidence. And that's, yeah, it's a tough thing to do. The injuries were basically overkill. And it's common in these cases that, you know, it's not killing someone, it's absolutely destroying them. There were multiple injuries, each of which could have killed her.
He pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, on the basis of claiming a psychotic episode brought about by drugs, but that was rejected by the jury. Tell us a bit about that.
From what I understand from the trial, and, you know, we've no special status in the trial, we're just like the rest of the public, he claimed that it was some kind of psychosis brought on by cannabis use, but there was no proof of cannabis. It was obviously voluntary intoxication. The legislation, as was explained in the trial, says, look, voluntary intoxication is not a defense against murder. So, like, no one forced him to take it. Whether it had the effect or not that he claimed, you know, that's all just kind of noise that he throws into the system to see if he can get off with a verdict, and a special verdict, they call it, which would basically let him get out, because it was clear from the psychiatrist reports that there was actually nothing wrong with him. As soon as he stopped, you know, as soon as he showed up in prison, he basically sobered up and he was grand without any intervention or whatever. It's very important he wasn't in the CMH or anywhere else. He was in prison the whole time.
Did he ever show remorse?
Zero. Absolutely nothing. Nothing until now. And look, we're 6 years from parole, which happens after 12 years. So anything he says now is purely, you know, with an eye on future, you know, future kind of getting out or getting something on parole. But yeah, there's been zero remorse shown to us, to the children, anything like that. And his actions speak louder than any words. He's been opposing us at every possible opportunity.
I know you're concerned about the privacy of the boys, and I can understand that. But you are looking for a legal change, which is very relevant to them, aren't you?
Yes, it's relevant to children in that class, you know, where one parent has killed the other. Obviously, a piece of legislation wouldn't be retrospective, wouldn't help their situation directly, but it would help going forwards for children in this case. And there's 7 children in this situation in Ireland every year, based on research. Every year, there's 7 children. And if you look at Europe, you extrapolate out and you're looking at 700 children.
Yeah, what are the implications of a convicted murderer being allowed maintain from prison the guardianship of children or a child left behind because he or she has killed the other parent?
So there's no effect on his guardianship. The implications are that he knows exactly where they live, and that's kind of tough for the kids and for anyone else who happens to be living with them. They don't live on their own. It's also the case that he can make decisions if they, you know, if they're allowed to go abroad. He's at involved in any major decisions around education or religion or medical procedures or anything like that. It's exactly the same.
So he has to give approval from the prison cell?
Exactly. Now,
you don't forfeit your rights in a way that if you kill a spouse or a partner, you can't inherit their property, for example, because there's been changes to the law on that in recent years.
There's not been changes in the Succession Act, and Kilroy gets, like, sorry to jump across to the property side because that's less important, but Kilroy owns the house. I know the minister is prioritising fixing some of that property space. Chris Cawley is the expert on that. His sister was murdered some years ago.
Many, many years ago. That's about 20 years ago. So I would have thought that issue would have been resolved by government by now.
It has not. There's many issues in this space. The Law Reform Commission brought out a report, Prevention of Benefits of Homicide. It's got a load of recommendations. There's loads and loads of recommendations. You look at the 2023 report, that's got a lot of recommendations for things in this space to deal with the aftermath, whether it's childcare, property rights or whatever. I mean, Valerie's pension is going to go to benefit Kilroy unless I can stop that.
Have you had any success so far in these efforts?
So I had a recent High Court win. Kilroy tried to block it, but I became the legal personal representative for Valerie's estate, and that was a win. Civil has to be after criminal, so we couldn't do any of that until the verdict had landed or until the criminal case was over. Now, Kilroy is appealing, but 98% of killers do. So that's the only practical win so far.
How difficult is it to go through all of that as well? I know it's minor by comparison with the loss of life, and it's minor comparison with the boys have to go through having lost their mother, and also knowing at the same time that their father is the one who is responsible and is in prison because of it.
It's difficult. It's hard to kind of, it's hard to compare these things. I mean, it's useful to have agency and to be able to pursue these things, but system kind of works against you and denies that this kind of crime ever happens. I mean, I was listening to Tuzla basically saying, look, we're here to help and support parents. And that's the mission of that agency, and that's very good. The problem is that that is blindly applied, and the help and support goes to James Kilroy, not to the uncle of the boys or to the aunts of the boys.
Or to those who might be actually looking after their upbringing.
For people who are concerned about them, and the whole point of this is that killing a mother is child abuse, and having an abuser in this position of trust over the children is not in their best interests. But the system is built to help and support parents, and that absolutely makes sense for practically every parent in the country, except James Kilroy and other people who kill their spouses.
It would strike me, as you outline this, that if you kill somebody, if you take their life, you should relinquish any rights that you have to their children, to their property, to anything. I mean, in time, if children decide they want to forgive a parent or to have a relationship, if they decide to do that as an adult, well, that's a decision to make as an adult. But up until such time, surely, as well as being imprisoned as a punishment for your actions, rights involving those left behind should be forfeited.
I agree. The rights are very separate. These are property rights and family law rights. The criminal justice system is completely orthogonal to that. It's like we have three separate court systems, and that's fine. We have three separate court systems, and the point of...
the three being the civil courts, the family law courts, and the criminal courts.
Yeah, yeah. That's basically the three separate parts work independently. And the point of Valerie's law, the guardianship law reform, would be to look at a verdict and say, right, we can take this piece of information from the criminal court, go over to the family law court and make some decisions as to whether it's in the children's best interests to retain this person's guardianship or to suspend it.
How tough was it to write the book?
In a way, it was good to write the book. There's about 10 chapters that didn't get into the book. It was something I was working on from the start. And, you know, you have to remember, we couldn't talk to anyone for fear of queering a trial. So you write stuff down on paper, you're exploring systems, you learn, you know, a whole bunch of random stuff. You know, what is compensation? What's the legislation? How does the criminal system work? You're writing all this down for your own benefit. Telling Valerie's story was really helpful. So, in a way, you know, it's therapeutic for someone to write that down. And I noticed, you know, Jacqueline Connolly, who has Deadly Silence out, would probably say similar. Sarah Corbyn
Lynch. We spoke to her last week. Sarah Corbyn Lynch, we also spoke to recently. She's a remarkable young woman.
Absolutely, absolutely. Massive respect for her. And she is the kind of person who would have been in this situation where a killer of a parent was basically convicted. And still that person, I know the legalities are very different there, but if all that had happened in Ireland, she would have been having Molly Martins as her guardian. And that is something that should be fixed.
This also has had a major impact in your life. And I know it's a secondary because your sister died, the children have been left without a mother, but presumably this has just completely upended your life as well, has it?
Yes, Sarah Benson calls that out. Sarah Benson, CEO of Women's Aid, calls that out in the foreword. The ripple effects go all over the place. Every relationship in the kind of families, victims' family space gets put under massive pressure. And, you know, one the immediate effect was our mother died suddenly, and it's not unrelated.
Was she a young woman?
She was living alone, driving around, good social life, obviously a pensioner, and suddenly gets a stroke and dies within months, and, you know, within months of the murder. And this was something, obviously, the murder of her daughter was an almighty blow on her. And I see this as directly linked. There's lots of other effects as well. You look at, you know, the first cousins of the children, you know, Valerie's nieces and nephews. You look at the effect on them. You looked at the effect on, you know, Valerie's siblings, their spouses and partners. Everyone processes this kind of event in a different way at different speeds. And massive pressure is put on all relationships. Some take it, some don't.
Look, we will leave it there. David French, thank you very much for coming in. The book is For Valerie, The Story of My Sister's Death at the Hands of Her Husband and Its Devastating Aftermath. And good luck in your campaign to make sure that real justice is done, not just for your family, but for other families where there are survivors after a murder.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.